Is everyone ready to go? Everyone recording?
I couldn't be any more ready if I tried.
Okay. So it's going to be that kind of day.
Happy Monday, folks.
I could be more ready, actually. I take that back. I can think of a variety of ways in which I could be considerably more ready.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. We've been tracking the partisan responses to the coronavirus pandemic on this podcast since early March. And back then, we saw that there was a real partisan divide in how seriously people were taking the virus, but noted that the gap might fade as time went on and the virus spread. And to some extent, it did. But as more time has passed, are Americans reverting once again to their partisan corners on coronavirus? Today, we're going to ask that question. We're also going to talk about the role that former President Barack Obama is playing in the 2020 election. After spending much of the past 3.5 years out of the spotlight, Obama is growing more vocally critical of the Trump administration, and in turn, President Trump has begun talking about investigating him. So what does this dynamic mean for the presidential election? Here to discuss all of that are Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. Hey, Nate.
Hey, Galen.
Also here with us is senior politics writer Claire Malone. Hey, Claire.
Hi, Galen.
And managing editor Micah Cohen. Hey, Micah.
Hey, you know, once we went remote, there was a run of Nate greetings that weren't awkward. But the past few weeks, I've seen a return to awkwardness from the Nate Galen
well,
hello.
It's a return to normal in our own way as society begins to heal.
It's Nate's reopening.
By the way, Micah, your beard is like really coming into itself.
You know what I'm realizing, though, is summer, beard, and mask is a really bad combination. I think I gotta trim it. But thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
I will also note here at the top that, you know, since we discussed this previously, and this is new news, Representative from Michigan, Justin Amash, has decided not to run for president, saying that the country is too partisan for him to break through. So we'll see who the libertarians put forward, but it is not going to be Justin Amash.
Vermin
Supreme.
Thought
I would throw that out there. Vermin Supreme very well could be. Have you been tracking? Who are the other contenders for libertarian nominee?
You know, John McAfee is perennial candidate.
Well, we'll see.
Can I say, I like how Amash figured out in the last couple of weeks that the country is really partisan. He's like, oh, actually, the country is partisan. I'm not going to run.
Do you think Justin Amash listened to our podcast and we influenced him?
Definitely. Absolutely. 100%.
No. It's a little bit, yeah.
Part of the reason I think he doesn't listen to the podcast is I've sent his office a bunch of emails asking for him to do an interview on this podcast. And if he listened to the podcast, you think he'd be more responsive and eager to do one. Mm. But maybe he was just figuring out whether or not he wanted to run and didn't want to talk to the press.
You might have that backwards, Galen. Listening to the podcast might make him less likely to want to come on.
Too afraid.
That's so true.
Too afraid. All right. Have we gotten the giggles out? Let's discuss whether and how the coronavirus pandemic has settled into the partisan divides that seem to dictate all kinds of views in American society. So we've seen protests on the right, and more recently in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, Republican politicians even working to undo or not follow stay-home orders. On the left, there's been a lot of hand-wringing that states are reopening too soon, even as Democratic governors open their states. So does that track with actual partisan divides, or is this kind of a vocal minority within the two parties? Claire, what's your take on how this is all forming?
Well, I think it is certainly something that has grown more politicized over time. You know, the initial numbers about coronavirus, I think, were kind of Americans in their most, you know, sort of naked, instinctual reactions to a pandemic crisis. And I do think you see these fault lines forming that have made the debate very black and white, at least in some of the online discussions. So just to lay out number stuff, we do see some partisan differences in the ways that Democrats and Republicans view the crisis. You know, the idea that more Republicans see the worst as being behind us and more Democrats see the worst as being in front of us. I think that's the Gallup number. And I think what we're seeing emerge in some of these, you know, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Georgia, states that are reopening or having conflicts over reopening, is that the partisan fault lines are now either we've got to go back to business and go back to normal versus, and I think this is a bit of a parody of maybe the liberal line, but we need to have a vaccine before we can go back to living, right? And that's kind of how people are characterizing each other's viewpoints. And I do think that there's something, the idea that the original discussion started with, we need to flatten the curve. And then we get into, and we talked about this a little bit last week, after we flatten curves, then you get into kind of the uncomfortable thing of people will die. How do you reopen society in a way that's responsible and palatable and doesn't freak people out hugely? Is that a fair summation?
Yeah. And I mean, what do we see, Nate, in terms of the partisan response on this? The caricature that Claire put forward, is that reflected in public polling, or is that just what the debate looks like online?
Yeah, I think you see two things, right? You see a split between the parties where actually it's an issue where Republicans probably are more conflicted than Democrats are, and Democrats are mostly on the side of maintaining social distancing, whereas Republicans are more divided. Now, if you look at it in more detail, if you give people an option of, hey, maintain distancing or open, then people will say maintain distancing by pretty wide margin still. If you give them a three-pronged choice, which is maintain distancing, open all the way up, or open selectively, then people like open selectively. And that's what most states are doing. So therefore, you know, it's not like the many states, including some of the harder hit states that are beginning to tentatively reopen, maybe more or less aggressively. It's not like they're kind of bucking what people want because their openings are tentative. But the other thing you see, I think, ironically, is like a little bit of a split between popular and elite opinion, where you see all these articles written by kind of influential conservative or libertarian thinkers, and they say, well, the popular will demands that we should open up, right? But actually, I think that demand is made more by a certain types of elites. And I think also kind of the more, although the public is generally pro-remaining careful, I think the strongest claims are often made by elites too on the other side of the debate, right? So it is a case not where you have some centrist consensus, right? You have a lot of disagreement that's taking place among elites. The public is kind of following along, mostly remaining on the side of being careful. But I do think, you know, I think Claire is right that what was meant by flatten the curve is a little ambiguous. I think the kind of purest, most literal sense in which it was used meant, to use a technical term we've used sometimes, so R, the reproduction rate, how fast disease is spreading, that was designed to get R lower, but not below 1, right? So you do some distancing, and therefore you flatten out the number of cases that occur over time, and therefore hospitals aren't as overwhelmed, but you kind of take it as inevitable that a large number of people are going to get it until herd immunity develops. Once, it depends on exactly what the parameters of the disease are, but until some substantial number of the population has it, half or more by most estimates. That's kind of what Sweden purports to be doing. At the same time, people also use that phrase just to mean, hey, let's just kind of crush the curve instead of flatten it, right? So try to get things down to zero. Technically speaking, that means it's called suppression rather than mitigation. So like a lot of terms, if you remember like the debate over Medicare for all, and at first it meant kind of, hey, any kind of commitment to get universal health care, but it also meant, hey, Bernie Sanders' plan. And like it's kind of the same thing happening for flatten the curve, right? Where like it was a generic term that people used in a variety of different ways, and they weren't necessarily being sneaky. If what they meant by flatten the curve is, hey, we want suppression, we want to get the number of cases down as low as possible, and that means pretty serious social distancing, it was also sincerely meant by people who thought, okay, well, flatten out a bit, spread it out, make sure the hospitals aren't overwhelmed, and then you kind of go back to semi-normal. But, you know, I mean, herd immunity means that like a lot of people are going to get it, and those people, some of those people will die, 1% or 0.8%. But the answer is like it has multiple meanings, and the most technically correct meaning, I think, actually maybe has changed a bit, but the way people were using it in practice, I think, indicated a whole bunch of different policies. And part of the problem for the people who want to remain closed is like they actually might have like 5 or 6 different strategies, right? There are some people who might say, let's kind of stay closed until we get a vaccine. It's not a very common position, right? But it's, you know, it's in the realm of debate.
why did the debate form along these lines? It isn't necessarily obvious that one is a Republican position or the other is a Democratic position. And if you look abroad, you see some people on the left who have been more opposed to shutdowns in Europe, for example. Sweden, which is not a country known for like bucking science, has never fully shut down. So what is it that has made this debate in the United States kind of fall along these partisan lines in the way that it did?
Well, I would point to a couple things. Maybe the least influential factor is that there are genuine ideological objections to government mandated restrictions, and those tend to come from the ideological right, you know, the more libertarian leaning, you know, the government shouldn't be able to tell you what to do or tell you what your business to do. So there's that, you know. Do I think that's playing a big role? No, probably not. More likely, I think it's a couple things. One is just partisan cues, elite partisan cues. You know, Trump, from the get-go, was in a situation where he bungled the response to the pandemic, did and does not seem interested or capable, at least, in trying to mitigate the spread of the pandemic in a super successful way. And so from his point of view, the biggest imperative is therefore, okay, let's reopen the economy so that the economy does better, so that my election prospects improve, right? Trump could have helped his election prospects by handling the pandemic really well. That's kind of out the window. Now his best chance to improve his reelection prospects is for the economy to come roaring back. And to do that, the economy has to reopen. So from the get-go, I think Trump and other Republicans who knew their, you know, as the party in the White House, they'd be held responsible for the economy, had an incentive to push for these restrictions to be lifted. And I think early on, you know, when all the message was flatten the curve, flatten the curve, flatten the curve, there wasn't a lot of room for those partisan cues to dominate people's headspace. Now that the actual health message is a little more muddled and all over the place, I think those partisan cues have really kicked in and you're seeing these gaps open up where there haven't been before. I mean, just to put a little data on it, you know, there was this Marquette University Law School poll of Wisconsin, and they found that in March, which was just a couple months ago, 83% of Republicans said, you know, school closures, business closures, restrictions on public gatherings were appropriate, 83%. That's down to 49% now. So it's a huge drop, 34-point drop. So I think that's the direct result of these partisan cues, right?
And that is a state that it's become particularly partisan, with the Republican legislature filing a case with the Wisconsin Supreme Court against an extension of the shutdown and winning based on a conservative majority on the state Supreme Court. So it is very partisan in Wisconsin.
Yeah. And we, you know, we haven't done this analysis ourselves yet, but Gallup looked at this. There are genuine differences in by place here, right? In how effective and how needed, you know, these restrictions are. And I think all along on this podcast, we've talked about, well, if you live in a rural area, of course, you know, where there's been one positive coronavirus test, of course, you're going to be like, why do we need to shut everything down? But the Gallup analysis Claire mentioned earlier tried to account for those factors. So they controlled for place and they controlled for other factors, like how bad the pandemic was in a certain area, and still found that these partisan differences persisted. So I do think we're in a spot where these partisan gaps are just partisanship, you know, that's what they are.
Yeah, if you look at actual behavior on mobility, so Apple and other companies actually track how often people are moving around or issuing requests for like driving directions or walking directions. That actually shows a partisan split. That if you try to predict what things predict where people are moving around more, it's basically three things.
One of which is weather, where in states where you've had more of a warm up, so the Midwest kind of cold states, people are moving around more relative to their baseline, right? In Hawaii, the weather's always nice. You haven't seen as much of a weather-related increase. Two is how many people died in your state of COVID. People in states that had severe outbreaks are being more careful. And three is partisanship, that controlling for the other factors. If you're in a state that voted for Trump, then you're more likely to be moving around. So it actually does affect people's behavior, and it's not purely just a matter of attitude, right? It actually does. I mean, again, Democratic states are moving around more also, right? So there's a bit of that. It's definitely universal, but it's more profound and more pronounced in Republican areas. It also does not have that much to do with formal reopening per se. People will choose where they want to go and do stuff, and there's a lot of stuff you can do, whether things are open or closed, and it may not be affected that much by your state's formal policy.
Yeah, I'm kind of interested in, I mean, I think warm weather, people are kind of getting quarantine fatigue. And I'm curious, if we're talking about this as a purely political issue, at least I'm not weighing in on when people should reopen, but the idea that could this become a potential political problem for Democrats or certain governors that people perceive them, whether rightly or wrongly, as being kind of, no, we got to wait. We can't open business. You can't get back to normal. Because there is such a an antsiness around, we want to go back to some semblance of, you know, something. You saw it in New York City this weekend, right? People are, there are bars that are doing takeaway drinks and people are kind of like standing on the sidewalks outside the bar, right? There's this natural instinct to be like, it's warm out. I want to do something. Does this become a problem for Democrats, the fact that they've been sort of painted, portrayed as anti-opening up?
I mean, for right now, they're on the side of public opinion. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there are some, you know, California is the one case where both states, the state and county, seem particularly conservative about opening up, even though they didn't actually have that bad of an outbreak. I mean, California did a good job, relatively speaking, of controlling coronavirus, more cases in LA than other parts of the state. I mean, that's the one where, like, if you might expect a backlash, it might be there, because that almost seems like I'll probably annoy a few listeners, right? The notion that LA County, I think their public health kind of flow the idea, we're going to be locked down for a few more months, right? That almost seems like it's on the other extreme of like, is that really evidence driven or is that just kind of laying down a marker? Because at some point you have to have, you know, some plausible benchmarks that would let you reopen, or else then it does seem more like, okay, we're locking down until a vaccine, which I don't think is the official stance of LA County. And so, you know, that's the one case where it also closing beaches where there's not that much evidence about transmission outdoors. But, you know, again, most states are beginning to do stuff that involves opening, right? Technically speaking, parts of New York are now open, although it's not the kind of retail and restaurant stuff that people want, but that's going to get phased in. Connecticut this week, some things are reopening. So it's not just like, you know, New Orleans, things reopened this week in some things, right? So it's not like all these states are in these internally long lockdowns. And I think actually kind of in some ways, governors are doing a very good job of following public opinion, given what I said earlier about like actually what most people want is a careful reopening. And that's kind of what we're getting in most states.
And also, to be fair here, some of those Democratic governors have amongst the highest approval ratings in the country. Whereas in Georgia and Florida, you know, with both DeSantis and Brian Kemp, you actually see pretty low approval ratings. So it's kind of the opposite of, so far at least, the concern that Claire was mentioning. But I think there is a question for these swing states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, where it is becoming more and more partisan. And I'm curious about like how this becomes a 2020 electoral politics issue, if it will, in those swing states.
That's kind of what I mean, right? Is the idea that, controversial as it was in Wisconsin, there are probably a lot of people who voted for, I don't know, Obama or Clinton, who are like, at the Madison bars, you know, the night that that everything reopened. Like, there is this kind of basic instinct to kind of want to get I tried to resist using it. But like, I'm, you know, I'm trying to think like a couple months in the future to like how all this looks in the rearview mirror when people are at the height of the presidential election, and you've got people who are more sort of crassly politicking and looking back on the past few months and saying, we were the ones who wanted to get small businesses back to work when your, you know, fill in the blank Democratic governor, you know, didn't understand the crisis fate is facing the middle class, whatever it is. You know, it's, this is, I do think the point about public opinion being tracked closely by governors is interesting. And I'm kind of also curious whether or not that's proper public health policy. I mean, I think that's something that's also, you know, the public doesn't know perhaps the best thing about public health concerns and the best way to continue to keep the curve flat. So
I actually think the public so far has seemed to have, at least enough of the public has so far seemed to have a good sense of what the public health consensus has seemed to be. I mean, where you've seen governors get really high marks is where, like, take Ohio, for example, right? Their DeWine acted fast, acted decisively, and followed the public health expert guidance. And there you see, you know, I'm looking at this Washington Post data, Washington Post poll, 86% approval in Ohio, which is crazy. And what's happening there is you have a Republican governor who's getting Democratic support, which, by the way, I think shows how much of a squandered moment this has been for Trump, because I think there was room there in a national crisis if you show leadership for partisanship to break down. And then, as Galen was saying, where you see notable disapproval is where, you know, in states like Georgia that seem to act against where the public health consensus seemed to be. So my bet, Claire, is it would be what you said about devolving into partisanship. Like, I could absolutely see that. That's kind of already what's happening. You know, in these states, like, will DeWine maintain bipartisan support up through 2020? Maybe not, right? But unless all of a sudden the public health consensus in 3-4 months is, oh, actually, this pandemic was way overblown and we shouldn't have done any of this, I have a hard time imagining that the public writ large would move against these restrictions, you know, in hindsight.
Yeah. And I'm not sure what I'm about to say is disagreeing with you at all. But I also think, you know, DeWine has a pretty public partner in Amy Acton, who's the state's health director. She's, you know, the Post had an interesting little profile of her, and there have been others in Ohio media too, that she's sort of an interesting parallel to Fauci. And Fauci and Acton have become kind of easy targets for partisans. I mean, you saw Fauci getting grilled by some Republicans when he came to testify, and they were saying, basically, you know, those people can become a good, like, fall man, for lack of a better phrase, for, you know, governors who are potentially, I don't know, if there's a weird space of in a couple of months from now, you can always say, well, I was just following the directions of my public health person. And you know, with hindsight being 2020, maybe we overreacted or whatever it is, that those very public health officials kind of add a new dimension to the whole swirling political stuff. This isn't like a super coherent way of saying it, but I'm saying there are a new element that is not typical in our partisan fights. These kind of staunchly apolitical figures, you know, we're so used to like just the lines in the sand being drawn.
Yeah. And if in 3 months people on the left are attacking those figures, that would be a sign, I think, that public opinion could move against Democrats for wanting to hold on to the restrictions. But that seems unlikely. You know, going back to Galen's original questionnaire, or one of his original questions, of did the partisan breakdown have to fall along these lines? Was it always slated to go this way? I think the answer is no. It could have went a different way if leaders had acted differently. I think DeWine in Ohio shows that, right? But it also, there are other reasons why you think, okay, this kind of makes sense. Not only the ideological reasons about not wanting government interference, but also there's always been much more distrust of experts and science and evidence on the right than on the left, although both the right and the left have pockets of it, right? But it's always been much more powerful on the right. It's much easier for people, for a conservative community to disregard what public health officials are saying, I think, than for a more liberal one, just based on kind of the coalitions and their predispositions.
I mean, to some extent, it is remarkable how much the public has listened to expert guidance, right? Most of society is not completely shut down, but substantial parts of everything we do is shut down. And as you said, Micah, approval rating is actually higher for governors that have made, I'm not finding the term I want to use, right? I'm going to say pretense, but it's not necessarily a pretense, right? But like governors who have you use language like, hey, we're driven by science and data and expertise. If you say that and you say, based on these scientific benchmarks, we're going to open up in 2 weeks, versus if you just say, we're going to open up in 2 weeks, we need to get people out and revive business, right? The former justification seems to be a lot more popular, even though they might result in like a lot of the same policies, right? There are also media biases, frankly, in like, you know, when Angela Merkel or a blue state governor or a Republican governor in a blue state like Larry Hogan announces plans to open up, right? There's no real, you know, no real kerfuffle about it, hand-wringing about it, right? I mean, Maryland actually is opening up, and they actually are one of the cases where things don't seem to be improving very much. So there is, I think, fairly clear bias towards certain narratives about these like dumb kind of red state governors, right? Is the media narrative. At the same time, they actually are pretty unpopular in their states relative to all these other governors who are not actually making policy that's all that different, but are kind of staying within the realm of, hey, we're being guided by the expertise. And that's just actually a very popular line. So it's pretty interesting.
Nate, I want to ask you, apart from the political and partisan motivations here, about 90,000 Americans have died from COVID-19 since the beginning of this pandemic. Now that we're seeing states reopen, have we seen any indication that there is a resurgence in cases or deaths? Is it too early to tell? Kind of where is the data pointing to this week?
So to start with facts here, right? The fact is that actually cases have been slowing down a little bit in the U.S. over the past week or two, especially if you look at the share of cases relative to the number of tests, because tests have been expanding a lot. And I'm a big advocate of looking at the number of tests. I think that's a better way to do it. So you've seen a decline over the past couple of weeks, but it may be a little early to know for sure whether that's durable or not, how much effect there is from reducing distancing. I mean, there are kind of three potential hypotheses, right? Let's say we don't get a big spike. It could mean three things, right? One, it could mean that actually, even though things are reopening, that actually people aren't changing their behavior all that much. Two, it could mean that maybe some types of distancing don't matter that much, that if you cut down on big like super spreader events and travel and large gatherings and work and school, that then you can go get your hair cut and go to a restaurant, and that's a pretty small fraction of activity. It's another possibility. Or it could mean that it is making it worse, but it's compensated for by other factors. There was a Harvard study that came out this week about the effect of weather. And the effect is not enormous, but it may be enough to kind of offset the decrease in distancing. And maybe they're about the same magnitude. So it gets a little bit warmer, distancing is a little bit less, and so it kind of evens out. Maybe people wearing masks matters a lot. Again, different evidence. Some people say they matter a ton. Some people say they matter not at all, right? The consensus might be that that is something that helps to mitigate damage, frankly, that might be caused by people doing less distancing. There are even things about like how many people are susceptible versus immune, right? In some places like New York, the state estimates that 20% of New Yorkers at some point had COVID. If you have 20% who had it, then that will actually not provide herd immunity on its own, but it will lower transmission rates to some meaningful extent. And so you kind of maybe have a bunch of different things, and you have more testing too, right? All people complaining about like, oh, not enough testing. Actually, there are a lot of states now where they have excess capacity and people aren't getting as many tests as the states would like. And so I think the message should maybe get out to the public that actually now it is much easier to get a test now, and you should, public service announcement, right? Get a COVID test if you have a good reason to get a test. It should not be that hard anymore in most states, depending on where you're listening to this.
Took me less than 5 minutes in New York, at least.
So Nate, because a lot of the data we're getting has a lag to it, and there's a lag between when someone gets infected and when they show symptoms and when they show up in the system, when would we be able to do the analysis to at least to attempt to figure out whether these marginal reopenings are changing the, you know, curve, so to speak, in a particular area or overall?
There's not a bright line, I don't think, because all these reopenings are phased, both within states. They might have different stages in different regions, and across states that kind of begin in late April and continue, or are scheduled to continue through May, some into June, right? So you could look at individual states. I mean, look, I think so far between the U.S. and also Europe, because Europe is also sort of reopening, or it is reopening, I think people might have adjusted their priors a little bit by now toward maybe not expecting a huge surge. I actually think some of the language is misleading, right? Like, I think if you like look at the evidence on how different spread was in Sweden versus example, where actually Sweden, a lot more people died than Norway and Denmark and Finland, because Sweden had much laxer social distancing as part of their, they're actually using a flatten the curve strategy, and that results in more people dying, right? And they're going to say, well, people are going to die inevitably anyway, they'll get it anyway, and so we're kind of just putting those up front. I don't want to debate Sweden here, right? But they didn't see gigantic exponential growth, right? They saw a long plateau, which is they're maybe still declining a bit or in the plateau phase now, right? So that would suggest that like people are expecting these gigantic spikes, and what you might get instead is a long plateau. And a long plateau could be just as bad, right? We're down to around 1,500 people dying a day. Do the math. If 1,500 people die a day for the rest of the year, right, that's a lot of people dying by the end of the year. And so, you know, the rhetoric became because of mixed dramatic narrative and people were trying to scare people into shape, I guess, right? All this rhetoric about like spikes when I'm more worried about plateaus, when you actually could potentially, you know, not crush the curve, but keep it going downward until the case count gets very low. If you look at Germany or countries like that, right, the numbers are very low. So whether they're actually growing a bit or shrinking a bit, if you're at a very low number, you actually maybe don't have to worry about that quite as much. But look, I think by this time next week, if we still see numbers going down, then we'll start to have to ask more questions about like, okay, maybe weather is stronger than we think. Maybe mask wearing has a bigger influence than we think. You know, being evidence open to evidence means that we have to like, first of all, wait and see, right? Or we could be talking about like, okay, actually we people really overdid it. Now we are seeing spikes, or not spikes, but like we are seeing steady upticks that are going to be hard to control.
We're going to, of course, come back to this question. You said this time next week. So we'll ask the question again, and we will keep coming back to it until we have answers to all of these questions. But let's move on now and talk about the role that former President Barack Obama will play in the 2020 election. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Lightstream. Are you paying more money in interest than you need to on your credit cards? Refinance your debt today with a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream. Quickly roll balances from multiple credit cards into one single monthly loan payment. Get a rate as low as 5.95% APR with AutoPay, which is much lower than the national average credit card rate of over 19% APR. Plus, there are absolutely no fees. The application is quick and easy and is 100% online, and you can even get your money as soon as the day you apply. Lightstream believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience, and that's exactly what they deliver. Apply today to get a special interest rate discount and save even more. The only way to get that discount is to go to lightstream.com/538. That's lightstream.com/538. The numbers, not the letters. Subject to credit approval, rate includes 0.5% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/538 for more information. We're back, and over the past week or so, former President Obama has made some news for being critical of the current administration. Reports surface that he called the government's response to the coronavirus, quote, an absolute chaotic disaster in a call with Obama admin alumni, and for saying that some leaders, quote, aren't even pretending to be in charge in a commencement address. So in response, President Trump has called for investigating the former president for, quote, Obamagate, which the president didn't really articulate what it is in a press conference when asked about it, but it appears to have to do with revealing General Flynn's name during the FBI investigation of him at the end of 2016, beginning of 2017. So we'll get to that specific Obamagate question, but just generally, Claire, why is Obama being critical of Trump now after remaining silent for so long? What is his calculation?
Well, I think Obama has talked about
He's been obliquely critical of Trump before, I think, and of our partisan environment, and actually got pushback from the left for saying some stuff, I believe, last year about kind of sacred cows on the left and sort of like hardcore partisanship. Why is he criticizing Trump now? Well, because for all intents and purposes, we're in a full-on general election campaign now, and he feels like he can kind of speak out and his voice will kind of cut straight through to Trump's performance rather than maybe sort of, you know, getting waylaid in talk of the Democratic primary. I also think it's, 2 months into a pandemic, Obama probably feels a pretty renewed sense of urgency about Trump and maybe, frankly, sees Trump at a very weak point and knows that he's a pretty popular figure in American life, or at least respected, and can have some sort of influence. And obviously knows that Trump kind of is goaded by him.
I think Claire's right that, like, pandemic, no pandemic, my guess is that Trump would have always came back to Obama. Obama, in a lot of ways, is like Trump's lodestar. Is that the right use of that term? Lodestar? North Star?
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people trace Trump even running to president to when Obama kind of eviscerated him at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. You may or may not ascribe to that belief. But in a lot of ways, I feel like this, and it fits so well with so much of what Trump does, but just calling something Obamagate is, it's just perfect, because it is the perfect representation of what this is actually about, which is nothing, really, right? There's not an actual scandal here. There is, I think, a desire on Trump and his campaign's part to go back to what they think, you know, propelled Trump to office in the first place, which was, I think, a kind of white identity backlash against the first black president in U.S. history. So as a result, you have this super nebulous scandal, quote unquote. Trump is asked to explain it, and his response is just like, we all know what this is about. You know, I don't have to say it. We all know what this is about. And the honest answer is like, at least in my opinion, I think we do. We all do know what this is about, which is like, Trump defines so much of his presidency in opposition to Obama, and that includes racial overtones, undertones, currents, undercurrents, like all of that stuff. So I think Obama was always going to be a part of this. Now, the fact that Obama's vice president is the Democratic nominee, and you have this pandemic in which I'm sure Obama is sitting on the sidelines saying, this has been a disaster of a response. You know, I think that's why you're seeing it kind of come more to a head now.
Wait, but so there are two things going on here. I mean, one is that Obama has made the specific calculation that he wants to start criticizing the president in ways that are going to get picked up in the media, right? Like, he knows what he's doing. And then on the other hand, you have kind of in response, Trump starting to talk about Obamagate, and maybe that would have come up all along. But clearly, this tension is emerging right now, seems right now instigated by Obama. And then Trump is bringing up these conspiracy theories or overtones towards something going wrong in the FBI investigation of General Flynn. So is this a good political calculation for both sides? Like, one, does Obama want to get in a high-profile fight with Trump in, you know, the following 6 months running up to the general election? Does Obama want that? And then two, does Trump also want that? Or should he just ignore the man?
Obama feels like his legacy, if Biden loses, his legacy will take a real hit, right? Two terms of Trump trying to undo the accomplishments of the Obama administration, whatever. But Obama was always going to be a huge part of this election, I think. He probably knows that Clinton was a, again, with hindsight being 2020, less than ideal candidate for the country where it was in 2016. And I think does feel like a renewed sense that he has a big part to play. I think, you know, I wrote about this a little bit, but, you know, how effective can Obama be at turning out voters that he had in his coalition in 2008 and 2012. I don't know. A lot of those people, a lot of those Obama-Trump voters might just be Trump people now. But he does have potential to push up the margins with people within the Democratic base. And I think that's a powerful thing. So I think he was always going to be a big part of this. And perhaps coming in a moment like this and taking control of his narrative, right? Knowing that Trump would always attack him, but being able to, particularly in a moment of pandemic, come in and say, remember me, I was kind of the calm, cool, collected guy versus Trump, who's sort of, you know, the Obamagate thing really, and his, well, you know what I'm talking about. It almost reminds me of like, you know, like an Andy Cohen Bravo Real Housewives reunion where it's, everyone's kind of like, you know what I'm talking about. Like, we don't have to say it, where it's like, is there a there? No, probably not. But it makes for good kind of like a foil, right? So
I don't think it's a smart strategy on Trump's part. Obama's popular, right?
Mm-hmm.
He was semi-popular, I think, when he left office. And as is the case with most presidents, once they leave office, they get more popular. You know, there was a political poll that came out showing that by, I think, about a 14-point margin, people thought Obama would do better handling this pandemic than Trump. And then notably, the poll also found that by about an 8-point margin, people thought Trump would do better at handling this pandemic than Biden. I think a lot of that is just like when you're the president, you have a certain gravitas that's conferred on you, right? That Biden doesn't really have, although he had some of that from being vice president. But let me put it this way. Who would be a stronger challenger to Trump, Obama or Biden? I think the obvious answer is Obama. Now, Obama being a prominent part of the conversation and a foil to Trump, as Claire said, is not the same thing as being the actual nominee. But I think the more Obama is associated with Biden and the more in voters' heads, the more voters think, oh, it's Biden and Obama and all that whole contingent against Trump, I think that's bad for Trump.
Wait, but then there's two kind of specific questions here coming off of that. One is, how much do surrogates actually matter? Does like Obama being in the mix and being vocally in the mix, how is this going to be any different from 2016, where he and the former first lady traveled all around the country talking to Democrats at rallies on behalf of Hillary Clinton, and then people didn't turn out to vote for the actual candidate? And then the other thing here is, you know, if Trump came to power on a lot of kind of disgruntled feelings surrounding Barack Obama and a lot of the activism that grew up from the Tea Party and birtherism and all of that stuff he was involved in for the 8 years that Obama was in office, that Trump was involved in, like, why isn't that a good bet for him to go back to what he's familiar with?
Because he has those voters already. He doesn't need
you gotta turn them out, right?
Yeah, and I think they likely will turn out. I think any presidential campaign at the very least activates those hardcore partisans. So Trump doesn't need some grand strategy to get to 45, 46% of the vote. I think he's going to get that. That's what he got in 2016. I think he needs a strategy to get to 48, 49% of the vote and to push Biden's share down. And I don't think associating Obama with Biden helps him do that. Now, how much do surrogates matter? Not a lot. Decisive thing.
Yeah, I don't know. Obama's not a normal surrogate, right? And he'll also be a different kind of surrogate than he was in 2016 when he was the full-time president. I think that there's also
how
a careful...
How is he a normal surrogate?
He's the former president from, you know, just one term of office ago. And I think it's a time in American life where... the crisis itself has thrown things into a different kind of relief. But I also think that Obama can be a different kind of surrogate in the sense that he's not going to be on cable news shows and he won't be doing every kind of podunk rally or whatever for Biden. I mean, he might do some, you know, like whistle stop stuff, but I think he can choose big platforms that allow him to speak long and speak presidential in a way that other surrogates just can't. I mean, you know, you're going to see at least 2 days of cable news coverage about his commencement speech from the weekend, right? You're already seeing stuff from Karl Rove going viral, right? But Obama can have, you know, the platform of an hour long address in which he makes points in that sort of long winded way of his that makes it feel in context and presidential. And by the way, I think that's probably something he's more comfortable with doing, is being a bit like set apart and being able to kind of give his long version of things. And that does make him a different kind of surrogate. He just has a different kind of resonance, in part because the American public is so close to having him as president, so close in time to his having been president, and is in such a particular time where the projected competency of the Obama administration is seen as pretty desirable by a lot of people.
Yeah. Nate, get in here. What do you make of Obama's role in the 2020 election?
Yeah, you know, I agree with the other panelists, I think. I think there's not that much need to overthink this. I think that Obama is fairly popular, although one way you kind of become more popular as an ex-president. I mean, he left office, first of all, he won two terms, and left office as a fairly, but not overwhelmingly, but fairly popular president. You know, one way you remain popular by being an ex-president is traditionally to remain on the sidelines. You know, George W. Bush has become more popular by just chiming in every now and then for signs of unity and showing people his weird paintings, right? And he was very disliked by a large number of Americans when he left office. So on the one hand, it's kind of not a smart fight, I don't think, for Trump to pick. And I think there's too much overanalysis of like, oh, it's actually clever for this or that reason, right? There's, by the way, in certain type of punditry, right, there is too much reluctance to admit that Trump might just not really know what he's doing strategically, that he's just kind of punching buttons, mashing buttons, and like, because being president's hard, right? He did not have a traditional skill set for the presidency, putting this in a relatively polite way, right? But for some reason, like, making the implication that Trump isn't savvy is kind of like against pundits' ethos. Whereas if you say like, well, he's conniving and actually he wants to reopen the country so it'll help him win re-election, like, that doesn't make any sense to me. First of all, people don't want to see the country reopen yet, at least if you make that a binary question. Second of all, like, if tens of thousands or hundreds of additional thousands of people die as a result, like, that's not going to look good for the president. People are very aware of these numbers. And so so the notion that, like, Trump is just being impulsive and he's frustrated, we're going through a tough time right now. I don't think he's made it much better necessarily, right? But, like, but he's just frustrated. He may have issues with Obama, and he probably can have enough people whispering in his ear that somehow there's some strategic rationale where he keeps doing it. But, like, but yeah, I don't think it's a good fight for him to pick. And the fact that Obama is kind of using some if you always conserve political capital to use in an emergency, right, you have to use it at some point. You know what I mean? You have to cash in your chips at some point. And I think just the monumental nature of this pandemic and the U.S. having one of the worst responses in the world, I might say maybe not the sole worst, but one of the countries that really struggle with it despite our advantages, right? I mean, that's a moment when if you kind of said, okay, I'm going to wait for a very special moment to weigh in, then this might be the moment if you're Obama.
It's the Lyndon Johnson school of thought, right? Why accumulate all the power just to accumulate the power? You're supposed to use it for something.
I also think what Nate said about just like, you know, kind of Occam's razor explanation for this stuff is totally right, which is like, I don't think Obama has some grand political strategy and chose this moment to weigh in for maximum impact or anything like that. You get the sense watching Obama. And by the way, even the comments he made on that call reportedly and in the commencement address were like pretty restrained. He didn't even mention Trump by name, right? But you get the distinct sense that just Obama is watching the government's response, believes it's been an epic disaster, and is saying and is responding accordingly. Like it, his tweet, which was that tweet he sent out, which was just like vote period. That was very telling to me in a lot of ways because it suggests to me like a level of frustration, which is pretty easy to imagine.
How many emails do you think were exchanged before they tweeted vote from his account?
That is such an interesting question. Because it was either like 300 plus or zero, right?
Right. Exactly.
Which one?
I think zero.
I think like 10 emails were exchanged.
Galen?
I mean, I think that the Obama camp has been more strategic than you described in him wading into the public discourse, but I don't think that that applies to that specific tweet. I think that specific tweet was like, all right, I'm going to tweet this, and it was not very much back and forth. But I think there was a lot of thinking surrounding what he would say in like the commencement speech and what he would say in a way that he knew would be leaked on the call with Obama alone.
Dude, Obama does not just like sit in bed scrolling and then be like, I'm going to tweet something. That definitely went through layers.
Nate, how many emails?
32. I don't know.
I mean, yeah, Nate emails all of us at least 32 times before he tweets anything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which, like, thank God. Because otherwise, who knows?
Trying to keep the people informed.
All right. So if one of our podcast listeners is a member of the Obama team who was part of that email chain, please let us know who was right about this. It was,
I'm gonna guess.
I guess me, it was zero. What did you guess, Micah?
I'm going to say that went through, I'm going to say two emails, just two emails.
Two emails? Claire said 30?
No, I said 10, because you have people 10. Giving different versions of what they should do, and then edits, and then blah, blah, blah.
Nate said
32. And then Nate
32.
Said 32? Okay. All right. So let us know. We'll come back to this next episode if we have an answer, but let's leave it there for now. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you. Leave us a rating or review if you enjoy this podcast.
Yeah, actually do it. Give us some love. We need to, you know, feel wanted and needed in this, you know, crazy media environment. Anyway, thank you, Claire, as well.
Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, Micah.
Thank you. While we're plugging things real quick, I would just give another plug to our new coronavirus podcast, which is amazing, Podcast 19. And also, we mentioned herd immunity a couple times on this show. Please go to our website and check out an article by Kaylee Rogers, Julia Wolf, and Laura Bronner. Without a vaccine, herd immunity won't save us. It's really good. So please check that out.
And also, we might as well mention Hot Takedown, 538 sports podcast, which is still podcasting throughout this crisis. If you want to know when sports are going to come back and who's making those decisions, you should go check them out, too. Anyway,
oh, yeah. If you're not listening to Hot Takedown already, you're kind of an asshole. Yeah.
All right. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, as we already mentioned, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store, or just tell someone about us. Spread the word. Tell your friends, you know, when you're having like your Zoom happy hour, or, you know, tentatively meeting up 6 feet away in the park, or whatever, you know, following your rules. Tell your friends about us. Anyway, thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.